organization, a civil society organization, which your landing and grounded in reality and so on. I wanted to note that those numbers you're suggesting, but kind of okay, but I just wanted to note for people's interest is that those are the kinds of numbers of people we serve. I particularly various departments and various pieces of legislation on what needs to be done. There's no confusion about that at this point. It's just about somebody, such as a portfolio committee like yourself, making decisions about those, taking some of those, taking us in some of those directions. So we believe that the central effects that must be achieved by the administrative provisions that you put in place through this bill are the protection of children that come into conflict with the law, holding children accountable for offending behavior, and then also preventing child offenders from repeating offending behavior. And that's what we think this bill can promote, and we're suggesting how it can do that later in this presentation. I just want to stop for a moment before I go into the content of the presentation and make a few points about, from a crime prevention perspective, why offenders are important. And obviously when I'm talking about offenders here, I'm speaking about children, but these points apply across the board to adults as well. Offenders in the criminal justice system are extremely accessible for intervention. We know these people's names, we know where they come from, and they're not the kind of undefinable mass of people out in the community who may be committing crime and doing things that we need to stop. These people, we know about them, and this offers us a very critical opportunity for crime prevention. The international trend that we know about, and this is from developed and developing countries where this data is collected, it indicates that a relatively small percentage of offenders are responsible for a high proportion of offenses. Now, one particular study done in 1998 tells us that 6 to 7% of young males commit between 60 and 85% of crime across several countries that we looked at. So what this tells us is that if we target interventions at the children that need them the most, at the offenders that need them the most, in some countries they call these persistent and prolific offenders, that those are the, we can actually tackle quite a vast amount of the crime if we're successful in doing that. The other key point that I want to raise is that adolescents, we must accept, and this is demonstrated through so many years of research all over the world, adolescence is the most common age period for law breaking throughout the lifespan of people. And we have a very youthful population. 42.3% of the population is under the age of 19. We have to expect a certain level of this problem, given these facts. The other important factor is the vast majority of child offenders, and this includes sexual offenders, will not grow up to become adults. And this is demonstrating the relationship to countries where this research is done. And it's equally important to note that damage that can be done by the criminal justice system in terms of creating and then or exacerbating the risk factors that already exist for some of these children. And then the last point, which is very important from our perspective, is that there's a very strong relationship between child victimization and child offending. We see it every day in our work. It's more or less the same families that the child offenders and the child victims come from, number one. The other aspects are that children can be victims at one stage and then become offenders or vice versa. It's the same child at a different period of their life. And so it's important, and you know, we can tell you many stories about a child who was sexually abused at the age of 9, nobody knew anything, the system failed that child, and at the age of 13 comes to our attention as a sexual offender. So we've got to be taking those patterns into account when we create those situations. So our recommendations are very similar to those you've heard already. In terms of, we're suggesting that to promote crime prevention within the school, we need to make provisions for all children to be assessed. We need to make provisions for all the children, all children to have access to preliminary inquiry, for there to be no restrictions on diversion. And we also make some recommendations relating to sentencing in terms of the important DSL recommendations yesterday. The sentencing must be accompanied with a proper program in place. just in terms of assessment, and I've made these comments in response to the issues you raised yesterday, around the two things that were raised yesterday was the capacity to assess and whether that exists, and the seriousness of the effect, and that was raised as a reason why some children were not considered, it was said that they shouldn't be assessed. Now, to deal with the first issue first, is the purpose of assessment is information gathering. So we believe if you take this from a crime prevention perspective, you have to collect as much information on every offender in the system as possible and more about the children who may end up in prison facilities and in other lockup type facilities and so on. So we believe there's no decision making that happens through an assessment. It's purely for the purposes of information gathering. And we don't understand why it would be necessary to exclude some children given this fact. Secondly, the capacity is to assess. We don't have any figures and we'd ask social development to provide those. My understanding of is that social development has accepted and in law they are required to assess all children from 2002. They've been developing their capacity to do that, and my understanding is that it is allowed 70-80% coverage that they have. That's my guess. And that can be verified with the Department of Social Development. What we can say is where assessment services do exist, they're managing to assess all the children. They're not leaving out some of the children. If they are assessing social workers or probation officers sitting at a court, they will assess every child that is arrested. And from our own monitoring research that the child has lived within the past year, where we monitored three sites, Maritzburg, Victoria Magistrates Court, and Rwanda Magistrates Court, it was clear that assessment capacity exists. Most children were being assessed, but this varied. And I would gather that a lot of this varied because there were no actual provisions made for children were being released immediately and not being assessed before being released. That is in the research report that we provided to all members of the committee. And then on the preliminary inquiry, I just wanted to note that this is a decision-making process, and it's important that we don't forget that we need to use the data that is available. Shireen Shaikh provided us with very useful data yesterday, saying that where the preliminary inquiry is being tested, 70% of cases are going to child. Now, the value of the preliminary inquiry is self-evident from that statistic. And then the last point I wanted to make was that the reason we're saying that every child should have access to diversion, it's an important difference. We're not saying that every child should be diverted. What we're saying is that it needs to be a legal possibility that every child can be diverted. This will have no substantial implications for practice, this change that we're suggesting, because the NPA has guidelines about which children, which cases are diverse. What we are saying is that there should be no restriction in the law for children as there is no restriction in the law for adults. And that children should not get less consideration than adults. And what a... Let's just talk about this flipping in there.
Thank you. Firstly, just to talk about why we've decided to focus on sexual offenders and not all kinds of serious offenders. And it really did relate to the expertise of the organization, and that this is what we're dealing with mainly. Certainly also because what we're seeing when we're reading the research is that young sex offenders seem to be responding better to programs around treatment and rehabilitation than other young offenders do. So those are quite compelling reasons for us to focus on this area. What we are concerned with is, as Cheryl has spoken to, the issue of preventing offending and promoting safer communities, as Barbara mentioned yesterday. And the fact is that right now the bill perpetuates a particular way of dealing with young sex offenders that we feel is counter to this, that actually in some instances may even promote recidivism. we looked for information on sex offenders, and it really was very difficult for us to find South African information. We understand the government departments do have it, but we really struggled to get it. What we could find was some smaller studies that had been done in South Africa, which showed us that around 23%, I think it was 23% in that study, there were a couple of others, of sex offenders are children under the age of 18, which was consistent with what we were seeing in bigger studies in more developed countries that are actually keeping this information. So we're seeing in those US, UK, Canada, a 20% range, which tells us two things. It tells us that children are not committing most of the sexual offences, but they are committing a significant proportion of the sexual offences. And then related to the point that Cheryl made, this would then be a logical place in which we can focus attention and focus resources in terms again of crime prevention. What was very, I mentioned this earlier, but just to see, the studies that we were finding, we were looking for recent studies, we were looking for studies in countries more similar to ours and not finding them, because this kind of data is not being collected. But certainly a very recent meta-analysis of a number of studies that were internationally based was finding that recidivism rates for young sex offenders were just over 11%, whereas for young violent offenders it was nearly 23%, sorry, 23.5%. Pointing out again that there's a rationale to work with these particular sex offenders. In terms of assessment, what I was reading and seeing coming through very, very strongly was that young sex offenders are not all the same. They're not one big group of young people who do these things for the same kinds of reasons. There's a vast array of risk factors associated with the behavior. And so the concern here is that this bill is treating the majority of sex offenders as one homogenous group and not addressing the fact that there are these differences and not treating people differently. The other thing was also to note the research is clear that young sex offenders are very different from adults, and we shouldn't treat children who are offending in this way in the same way that we treat adults. Some of the issues were, for example, that there is higher risk taking behavior in youth, and that's motivating more of the sexual offenses amongst youth. Also things around influence by peers and social groupings in young people being more compelling a risk factor than in adults. Briefly around treatment programs, there's this feeling that these are soft options, and Joan Sanica yesterday morning did mention that these are not soft options. They're not as punitive as sending someone to prison and all of the associated punishments that go with that, but they do require accountability. They do require that there be some kind of reparation in whatever form is possible, given the nature of the offense. What we've seen is that, treatment programs can be offered at any stage. So they can be offered as part of a sentence or as an alternative sentence, as well as a diversion. But what little research I could find on this was suggesting that the sooner the better. And they were talking about being in the system often exacerbates some of the thinking that enables the sexual offending in the first place. The taking no responsibility for yourself. And then the big question that I was looking for is, does it work? Because I am and have come from a background of working with victims for the last 12 years, and I'm very skeptical and have been that these treatment programs might be something that we're letting people off on. And I was very, very heartened to see quite compelling evidence that treatment programs are working. And again, the same meta-analysis that was done 2006, showing again a significant difference between recidivism rates in children who have been treated and the children who have not been. And also to say I was looking for children, because there's a lot of research on adult sex offenders, and it's a much newer field of research on young sex offenders. So we've seen that they do work if they're done properly. You can't put any treatment program in place and expect it to work. So we're not advocating that, you know, we should have any more treatment program available, that minimum standards, et cetera, as set out in the bill, will need to apply. The problem is we don't have a lot of them in this country, but we do. There are programs like Child Lines, like the Teddy Bear Clinic, which are using the principles that have been developed internationally. And, you know, this idea that, look, we don't have the resources to make these programs available. We're not saying that they should be available to each and every sex offender, but certainly that there should be space within the legislation or the policy framework that enables enables us to continue to develop these kinds of programs. Now I get to the part I have to, I wanted to applaud when you spoke about the complicated nature of the bill, and I do have respect for the doctors and the difficulties they may have felt along the way. I don't need to respect either. But I was really challenged to try and make sense, right? I was asked to look at how this bill is accepted. It was a challenging process. But I will leave it at that, because I think you say everything I would have wanted to say about it. I then tried to make it a
I did, Judge, that if I allow her to say anything more about her talent, so you would have been a lot of frustration to see her. You might have to wish to
say. You've got big words to me. You never know. So I have printed a little schedule of my own, just to add to the schedule, which outlines or pulls out the sexual offences within the schedule, and very briefly underneath each of those talks to what it means to have an offence in one of these categories. But I'll talk through some of that quite briefly. What I want to just point out before I start this discussion is to ask people to look and see that we've got a range of offences, from any rape to very serious rape, rape, for example, of a baby or an elderly person, gang rape, etc. In a list which includes sexual exploitation of children and grooming of children, also very, very serious. It includes exposure or display of pornography to a child, and then using a child in pornography or benefiting from pornography. It also includes trafficking. Part two of Schedule 3 is then split into two in how it's managed in some sections. So it's looking at sexual assault, which are all of the non-penetrative acts, non-penetrative sexual offences as defined in the new Sexual Offences Act. Causing a child to witness an act, etc., flashing at a child, and then showing child pornography to an adult. I don't want to say the second level of seriousness, because I think the levels of seriousness is confused, but these are treated as what seems to be a second level of seriousness in the bill. Deals with all other rapes when committed by a child under the age of 14, because the first one was children committing particularly serious rapes who are under 14. Sexual assault which involves, sexual assault on a person under the age of 16, and then consensual acts of sexual penetration. So item 4 of Schedule 3, Part 2, deals with where there's consent between young people, not just for sexual penetration, which is rape, vaginal penetration, oral penetration, and anal penetration, but also sexual violations. We've always said to you, but it's the acts that are not consensual in nature. And then it goes further to list Schedule 2, a range of other sexual offences, such as the rest of sexual assault, when that would be on a person over 16 and where there is no assault DDH associated, causing adults to witness sexual offences, showing adults, flashing adults, showing pornography to adults, etc. The last schedule was the easy one for sexual offences, which had this reality. And the only note I have to say about that is that it's here. So what I want to say about the levels of seriousness is that clearly we've got very serious offences which are mixed up in schedules with slightly less serious offences, and the most glaring example of that is in Part 1 of Schedule, I'm getting lost now, Schedule 3, and that is that you have showing pornography to a child. And remember, for the purpose of this discussion, it's by a child, not by an adult, for this particular book. So one child showing pornography to another child, or one child showing in their genitals or the female breasts to another child, being treated as seriously as gang rape. What we would suggest in relation to this is that the committee look at how the Sexual Offences Act, which was passed at the end of last year,
amend the schedules of the minimum sentencing act, the school title 105 of 1997, because it seems to have said three of offences and said one of the most serious sexual offences in the Sexual Offences Act that should then be related to the minimum sentencing legislation. And the minimum sentencing legislation schedule also has different parts. Sexual offences are mentioned in two of them. This is how, and this is an excerpt from the written, it's written for more lay persons, but it is, I believe, accurate. In part one, which you've got what I'm now starting to refer to as your worst forms of rape, is rape that results in the death of another person, and then rape where there's a gang rape or a multiple rape, or the person is HIV positive and knows it, where they rape somebody with a mental or physical disability, where they rape a child. So those, as I'm saying, are worst forms of rape. Those offences, according to the minimum sentencing legislation, require a minimum sentence of life imprisonment. The next set of serious offences, which are referred to via the Sex Offences Act in terms of amending it to fit the sentencing legislation, refer to offences that are seen as being very serious but not the worst form. And they were for first, second and third conviction respectively result in a minimum sentence of 10, 15 or 20. And those are any other rape or composer, sexual exploitation of a child or person with a mental disability, or using a child or person with mental disability for pornographic purposes. So you don't have flash, you don't have displaying pornography, you don't have any of those things that are currently within the most serious section in E2 degrees. And what we would recommend is that Schedule 3, Part 1 and 2 be rationalized to fit this. That Part 1 of this schedule being Part 1 of Schedule 3 in this, in our bill, and Part 3 of this schedule become Part 2 of our schedule. And all of the other sexual things fall into Schedule 3. Talking about the implications, and this is where that little table that I've prepared, my new schedule that I've added, may be a little bit helpful. It says, without having to go to six different places in the bill, it tells you what the implications are if you are charged with an offence that falls within the sort of past position. And I actually did want to say also that something that's a bit of a problem is that Part 2 of Schedule 3 gets dealt with differently in different parts of the Act. So the first bits of it are dealt with differently for a sentence that's preliminary inquiry, as opposed to a sentence for sentencing, as opposed to any expansion of records really holds. So if we would ask that, draw a line somewhere and keep that line. So in terms of Table 1, and I've lost my Table 1, these offences are the offences for which assessment is not available. Sorry, for children over the age of 14. Preliminary inquiry is not accessible. The possibility of diversion is not available. And they do not qualify for And I'll ask you to again just look at those offences. You're not only talking about gang rape, you're talking about two 15-year-olds hitting and taking their clothes off in front of each other. You are committing an offence. So consent is not a requirement for exposure of your body to another child. Okay, so it's a crime to expose to a child. So, and we know there's been a lot of debate about how this is taken up, but I do think it's what I want you to note is that the offences that the Sex Offences Act was defining was for the purpose of protecting children from adults. And now it's being used in this bill, and it's actually being used against children who engage in what may not be comfortable for us as adults, but what is relatively more than before with their children. Even as I think Anne Skelton mentioned yesterday, showing pornography. It's not showing how pornography is in other times, which is it's also showing normal pornography, adult pornography. And as much as we don't want 15-year-olds running around school showing each other pictures on their cell phones, I don't think that we want to put it in this way. We did make some suggestions to the department. important part is that certain offences listed within items 4, 5, and 6 of Part 1 are required, according to the law, according to Section 78, it's required that the, if child over 16 is convicted of any of these offences, they must be sentenced to a term of imprisonment. So although the bill articulates the principle of imprisonment as a last resort, it is actually using imprisonment as a first resort if you're over 16 years old and you are convicted of one of those offences. And it's the list that I showed you that I was taking. Then in terms of Table 2, which is much better, Table 2 is probably split between half of Part 2 of Table 3, etc. And our concerns lie mainly with the rest of Part 2, the items 1, 3, and 4 of Part 2 of Table 2. Because the bill says that children who are accused of being offenses do have access to offenses and to preliminary inquiries. However, children who are 14 years and older and who have been accused of those three, item 1, 3, and 4, do not have access to diversion. Now, if you look at what's in there, again, it comes from this. It's rape by a child under the age of 14 that cannot be diverted. It's sexual assault on a person under the age of 16 years old. Now, with respect, many children who are, and I think sexual assault is a serious crime, I'm not wanting to minimize it, but children who commit sexual assault are likely to commit against other children. Children between 14 and 18 are highly likely to be committing it against children under the age of 16. And then under the age of 16 was again something that was, as I understood it, something around the fact that when adults commit crimes against children who are under 16, it's much worse than if they commit against slightly older. So I think you're going to find that most of the children who are accused of sexual assault will fall into this category of item 3. And then of great alarm is the fact that item 4 says that children who commit these acts of consensual sexual penetration or violation do not have access to diversion. The Sexual Offences Act requires that the only the National Director of Public Prosecution for an act of penetration and the Regional Director for an act of violation can decide whether or not to prosecute. So it makes prosecution really hard. This bill is now saying that you either prosecute or you withdraw, because you cannot divert. And that is extremely concerning, obviously. So my final point for really to reiterate what has been said before. We would still argue that noting your concerns around availability, that it definitely be available for all offenders, and particularly sex offenders, because it has benefits for us as citizens, and it certainly benefits citizens. Diversion be considered, we don't think that it will be appropriate for all young sex offenders, in fact any young sex offenders of serious nature, to be diverted. But as Carol was mentioning, there's this piece of space that's in the things we must improve teaching programs. I don't think these children would need to be better language. There's no good for any of us if children are going into a system where they are exposed to all sorts of harm and come out and tend to pose a greater danger to all of us. And that minimum sentencing must not apply.
Okay, you know I've just taken your full half an hour. So that's fine, no, fine, and we'll take some space so we can engage with you outside the meeting as well. But for now, some very good questions. We have a good 20 minutes left of our time. Yeah.
Thank you for the submission. And particularly on that consensual issue of children not being diverted, I think we need to look at that very carefully. So that wasn't my understanding when we were considering the bill. The whole fact that we put it in was with the idea to divert. But we need to look into that whole consideration. But so then the chance does raise the other issue of the plight of the target, but share the issue of the kitchen that came up so much in the papers. And as a portfolio committee, we need to express ourselves on that. I think it did deviate a lot of the good that was done in the sexual offences bill. And if the wording can be read, and it seems that it could be read in that sense, we need to look at an amendment to the sexual offences bill to make it very clear that at no stage did we intend to legislate about against kitchen. It's ridiculous. But it's just huge publicity in newspapers. I don't know if you picked that up as well. Slightly off the target, but we need to look at that. Yeah, yeah. But I do think it's something that we might have to look at if there is a problem. But that's slightly off the target. I myself will do it, I can't just say that. But we're not agreeing that that is the way it can be read. We just say we need to address that in a particular public domain.
Thank you. I don't know what to respond in detail. We just received that there's an awful amount of information that has been put across us, and I suggest that we will, in any event, in the department, then absorb what has been said here, because it does sound like what Mr. Swartz has raised about the really potential things that we will go through this and try and come back and respond appropriately. I think I'll leave it at that
point. Very detailed, yeah. I've heard this twice today. People ask for information from departments and they don't get it. Now, here again, it's repeated. But you've been asking for it. Which departments are not giving information? And the right law, are they refusing it?
Jim, there is a level of secrecy around information from several departments, but it's quite tempting. We made a request to the ICTJ for all the information.
What's
the ICTJ? The committee that's chaired by Shireen and the Department of Justice. Several government departments report that to them, they provide.
Oh, yeah, the inspectoral thing, yeah.
Yes. And we have on other occasions made requests to individual departments. A lot of the time we get the response that the minister has to approve the release of the information. We have made a particular recommendation in our submission that this legislation should require the minister or all those departments to report that information to Parliament once a year, so that it will assist in your own staff responsibilities and certainly help us do our job better in terms of service delivery.
Lots of this meeting and maybe TG can help as well. There are some things in the most open of society. This extreme is my example. I don't know of a capitalist society. Well, forget I don't know if society is more open or transparent than the Scandinavian society seems to be. Now, obviously there too, the executive must have some rights to keep certain documents private and confidential, government operate like that. But outside of those very few examples or cases in which they can, you can't turn down anybody in which our constitution is open and transparent. There's an act that this very committee passed, isn't it? And if a citizen asks for information of a department, frequently, in one particular slide, isn't it? Under what circumstances, besides national security, can an executive affairs department refuse to give information?
Promotion of Access to Information Act is the criteria set out there.
Somebody, if I have information from that intersectional committee and I'm in civil society, why can't I get it? Is there some part of that law that's prevents me from getting
it? It would be some of it, yeah.
But can we explore it outside this meeting? It's a general thing about the process. I don't know why we're so patient. With the open democracy. Unless we're seeing the constitution, it's simply not true. Let's change the constitution. Get through this majority to change it. But while it's there, we have to apply the law all of us. So I don't know what's the problem, but we can confirm it after this meeting. And we will come back to you, Phil. I know that you'll send me emails in the morning. So I'll have to reply to you. Okay.
No, I've said nothing.
The next quick thing is These figures that they give, Ron, are they consistent with your own? They are consistent with your own information. All these figures that they give, 23% of sex offenders are children, that they are less likely to go back to doing what they did in the first instance. All those figures are consistent with this record. And then we pick up the point, since the divergence, I'll drop there. And then what you could help us, also like anybody here, is to simplify the schedule. Then there's also a question about the relationship and consistency between this bill and minimum sentencing and sexual offences bill. Is that correct that they're not consistent?
I think in all respects, but it's something, as I said, I'm going to go into great detail of study this.
Together, more serious and less serious offences in the same schedule, and then moreover, you treat them differently. The expungement, I think, is differently. So, can you check it out?
Yeah.
And Lolly and Christine, can they go and check it out? Okay. And can members also? Ultimately, we can get a high smart ticket for people, but we have to apply our mind properly. Okay, thank you very much. Next thing is, where are we? With the Department of Social Development from UCC. Are they here?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Social Development at UCC. And we make a commission to the portfolio committee. I am a lecturer in that department, but my three main is probation and correctional practice. And then, for introduction, our department has a particular, Chulane, Chulane Kobane. Sorry for that. Our department has a particular interest in the matters relating to good probation practice, which promotes proper management of children in conflict with the law. And of course, the joint forces with advocacy and lobby groups in pursuit of these goals, but also very important for us to align our training or our tertiary education with the needs of the population out there. And of course, we are pleased to note that the bill recognizes and accords probation officers a central and prominent role in the proposed child justice system. Our submission will focus mainly on aspects pertaining to probation practice. Starting number one with assessment. Looking at the issue of definition and the purpose of assessment, we then move on to child offenders, which ones do you think are suitable for assessment. Then we look at the age factor in the whole issue of assessment. And then we look at assessment procedures. Then the next point that we'll cover is the pre-sentence investigation report, and then finally the registration of respect of children who are diverted. The Department of Social Development at DCT, as some of the people here might know, we have been involved in a period of over 10 years in a number of important developments of occupation-specific research and training programs for probation practitioners, which includes, of course, the development of our postgraduate qualification at an honors level and at a master's level in probation correctional practice. And then, very importantly, in July 2003, we were tasked by the National Department of Social Development to establish an approved training for curriculum for assistant probation officers, which I put an acronym of ACO. And yes, and we have also in the past researched now with probation officers and provided training for probation officers in the field in all provinces in South Africa in aspects relating to their daily practice. What that simply means is that we went out to find out what are your needs, what are your challenges, how can we help you overcome if we have to develop a specific kind of training to address your needs as probation officers. and of course numerous workshops were held on subjects ranging from psychology of the criminal court legislation relevant to probation practice, the probation officer as an expert witness and authority of justice, as well as issues of developing and implementing crime prevention programs, particularly in the disadvantaged community. And as I've noted in the probation submission, we do take into cognizance other documents pertaining to probation practice, the one with the guidelines developed by the Housing Department of Social Development, the practice guidelines, and also the minimum standard for diversion. And then starting with assessment. One first issue that struck me is the narrow definition of assessment as provided in the bill. We also that it's very narrow, and of course, and even the purpose is very narrow. And then for us, assessment is an important and fundamental component of practice, particularly working with troubled children. We therefore propose an addition to the present as provided in the bill, that in chapter 5, I think they provide a much, much broader definition of, the Probation Services Act 116 of 1991, they provide a much broader definition of assessment, which reads that a process of development, assessment, or evaluation of a person, the family circumstances of the person, the nature and circumstances surrounding the alleged commission of an offense, its impact on the victim, the attitude of the alleged offender in relation to the offense, or any other relevant factor. I want to emphasize this because it is in the way that you conceptualize about assessment that you will realize that who should do assessment and what kind of assessment would require particular skills or knowledge. Now, of course, there are different types of assessment, and some of them, of course, will need somebody with more advanced kind of knowledge, but some of them are just basic assessments. And then these will include some of the types of assessments. Just determining whether the child should be kept during the investigation, some of them establishing the age of the child, which I think was mentioned yesterday, that so we have to be careful, but probation officers may not be quite skilled in this, because that would include consulting with other professionals in that area. Other assessments is the criminal capacity, most common is the suitability of the child for diversion, and the suitability of the case for conversion to children's court. And very, very important for us is the developmental assessment. I want to emphasize this because our intervention, whether from the justice side or social development, is that we try to look at the long-term impact of what the child is done and also of our interventions with the child. So we try and look at the child in a whole developmental way as we work with the child. And of course, some of these type of assessments will require a skilled person to do them. And proper assessment, of course, is a complex process, and of course it can be very time consuming, and of course we want to take the realities of the court world in South Africa. Therefore, in light of this current situation in South Africa, the shortage of social workers, the probation officers, and of course in the best interest of the children, we propose the extension of certain types of assessments, such as those that need to be conducted prior to the preliminary inquiry to other future qualified persons as prescribed. And I know maybe becoming a problem might get it over and over. But please pardon me. I just have to say where we're coming from. Please pardon me. Yeah. And of course, child offenders are suitable for assessment. In section 35 of the bill, it says that existing place on the probation officer to assess children under 10, children who may be in need of care and children being considered for diversion directed by the prosecutor of a preliminary inquiry due to the nature of the offense that is allegedly committed. However, children who are 14 years and older child with crimes is set in part 1 and schedule 3 and offenses 2, 5, and 6 of part 2 of schedule 3 who will be referred to the child justice court are excluded from assessment. This is of course a concern for us because in our view of course diversion may not be appropriate of course for all the child offender, which is true. It is our submission that all the children need to be assessed, like I said earlier, that different types of assessment which can help. And I'll come later to another important issue that we need to take cognition of. And then we need to amend Section 5 to make provision for this. And then the age factor, we also want to draw the committee to the attention that most of the children work with, because they are troubled children, they come from disadvantaged backgrounds. You will find that sometimes in assessing a child, of course, you may need to draw upon some of the other professionals who may have more expert knowledge in this area. You will find the reason of the child doesn't correspond quite well with their age. In other words, you may have a child 14 years age, but their reason or level of functioning may be functioning at the level of a 10-year-old. And from my experience, having worked in this field, you will find that more often, these are the kind of children which will be used by adults. In other words, you will target them to use them to commit crime. And then moving on to the assessment procedure. Of course, the whole notion of assessment must just be viewed as a process. We give probation officers give assessment, you know, at the beginning, a minute after what the child has been arrested, but we need to look at what's going to happen to the child in terms of development. So in other words, we need to look at it as a process rather than as a single event, taking into account the long-term benefits of our interventions with the child. And then Section 39 and 40 do not fully reflect this kind of perspective I'm talking about. Our proposal is that these sections be less prescriptive about who may attend assessment, and that this matter be covered at the discretion of the probation officer in Section 42. In other words, that's the person who will decide who may attend, who may not attend. And then point number two, the pre-sentence investigation. For the purpose of pre-sentence investigation and report is to provide the court with adequate information on the offender as a person to enable the court to pass an appropriate and effective sentence. And then currently, the situation in South Africa, probation officer is considered as a professional in the court of law, as an expert witness, and that this person is considered as an expert because they have a skill, they have knowledge, and they have skill, knowledge and experience probably in this field. Now, pre-sentence investigations and report writing requires knowledge, of course, in theory and the objectives of punishment, knowledge currently on the Criminal Procedures Act that guides sentencing, and a range of alternative sentencing options. Of course, ideally, a probation officer or a person with a postgraduate qualification in probation correctional practice would be more suited for this task. However, taking into account the shortage of probation officers in South Africa, which leads to unconstitutional delays in the sentence of convicted child offenders, we therefore support the extension of pre-sentence investigation duties to other suitably qualified persons as prescribed. Moving on to the third point, which doesn't have a title there, if you look at your written submission, is the register in respect of children diverted. That should be the title on the slide. Section 54.5b makes provision for a register to be kept in respect of all children diverted, as well as for access to this register by probation officers, police officers, officials and court officials. In light of our foregoing argument about the importance of assessment of all children, we want to propose here, in terms of privacy, the consideration that these register needs to be propose that this register should only be accessible to probation officers. And of course, as we said earlier, it's been argued earlier that we shouldn't disadvantage children, even those who have been diverted before.
Okay, question. Please, Blair.
Yeah, I think that's working. Not. Your last point is probably your weakest. I'm sure that you concede that police officials must have access, court officials must have access
subsidiary, because otherwise, how are they going to do their job? So I think that's probably your weakest point of your whole argument. I can appreciate your other one, but your last point is not very compact, I must say. So, but that's just a comment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. You said, and it was also said yesterday, that we have a shortage of probational officers. Now, yesterday it was suggested that we use graduates in psychology and criminology and also maybe ex-teachers as probation officers. Could you comment on that, please?
In terms of expanding on the pool, but I would also add people like assistant probation officers, because they work closely with probation officers. From their experience and those of them training and participation in that would also be suitable. And also the child and youth care workers would also be suitable, because now they understand young people and the organs who work with them in different areas, in different settings. So those would also be suitable. But in addition to those which were mentioned yesterday.
Can I just ask
your experience on the ground of social workers? You indicated the shortage. What coverage are you experiencing at the moment? Are they able to? Would they be able to do this work if we had four assessments of all children?
Well, I wouldn't have the figures, maybe accurately. But I think for me, we need to delegate some of the tasks. But that's why people are overwhelmed, because they're expected to do everything. So if the social worker is there, then the assistant probation officers are sort of employed by the government. And I think it's a good move by the Department of Social Development that they're employing more now assistant probation officers. Certain duties can be delegated to assistant probation officers.
Covering some of the ground, I mean, I think this issue of extending, having the assessments conducted by any other suitably qualified professionals. Given that, I think it would have been useful to have had a submission giving more detail as to that. What kind of people are you envisaging as other qualified, suitably qualified people? What's your assessment of their ability to perform the functions expected of them? Because I think that's going to be the nub. Whether such people do exist, whether they can, or exist in sufficient numbers, whether they can perform the task proposed. So I think that so far your responses have been fairly anecdotal. I think it would be very useful if you could do a more detailed submission on that category. That's sort of the first point. The other thing is I'm not really clear. You complain about the purpose of assessment as defined in the bill being too narrow. You want a definition of assessment, this is the one in the Probation Services Act. But, I mean, maybe I've missed something, but I mean, the definition in the Act, or the bill rather, refers to probation in terms of Chapter 5. To my mind, the purpose is quite broad. If you think it's narrow, what are the clauses that should be added to widen it? I think that would be useful. I'm not sort of following why you think it's narrow. What's missing in that? So I think that's the other one. And then the main point we're making is you think, which other people have made, you think everybody should be assessed. Which is I think the point that there's sympathy for, but the problem is sort of the capacity to do that. Sure, it's being then suggested that people other than assessed than probation officers conduct assessments. But I suppose what I really want is more of a comment of there's no use putting something in law which cannot be achieved. So there's no point in saying everybody must be assessed and then there isn't the capacity to do that in the immediate term, the very short term. So have you looked at that aspect? Do you feel that there is the capacity to assess everybody if we revert back to the position of every child offender having to be assessed.
I don't spend too long replying to that. If anything, we will vigorously engage with the department, social development department. But you know what would help? If all of you would feel this view, you've got two people to coordinate, you can all give us the evidence for what you are saying. So basically saying it can't be done. The department is actually saying it can't be done. The portfolio committee in 2002 said it can't be done. So give us the evidence, you've got 2 weeks to do it. Put it together. And you're an academic. So, you know, this is something that you can do relatively quickly and easily. Although it's not the budget allocation, it's not an indication for us. I'll keep the professor now doing it. But, you know, we really need the evidence instead of a general remark. We have to send it to more than this one. Hey, I think the hardest person here will agree with it. Of course, he's very good. And the answer maybe that arises from what you're saying. You see, the other thing is, if you make a bill too, let's say, ambitious, not romantic, and the word ambitious is used in a specific context now, too ambitious in terms of what's achievable in the immediate period, not ambitious in terms of long-term goals, then you lose out a lot, you know? Like, if you want assistance for everybody in our provision offices, you'll probably get fewer assistance than if you limit it. Assistance in the first place. So those are things I have to think about. But please answer.
I'll try to think about what's that area. I think that's why we're making these proposals. I think we're going to expand. Because children, you know, wait for a long time for a pre-sentence investigation and then same assessment, you know, before the prison inquiry can include other people, like I've said already. We've developed a curriculum for African probation officers and such a way that at UCT we welcome people, even if you don't have the social qualification, to come to our honors or master's program in probation correctional practice. Unfortunately, those people cannot practice in South Africa because they're not social workers. That limits the pool. So some of the people do get our qualification, but they can work overseas because of our qualification. So looking at those kind of people, opening up you know, the pool more and more for, you know, people that you think have got some kind of training, assessment, or understanding the childhood development and all that. And of course, it should be difficult to provide proof without the curriculum that, you know, these people, you know, have to study at university or different areas of institutions.
These people cannot stand because they're not social workers. But some of them are very, very good, even more than social workers. Because some of them have got years of experience as well. And they actually do a turnover of social workers. Some of them end up teaching new social workers, you know, about what's going on in the field. So, yeah, I think the challenge is taking us, of course. And until we expand or change law, then we'll be able to meet the challenge. Oh, yes, sorry, I forgot to report. Yes, I think for me, once we understand that airport of assessment, then we have a long-term kind of understanding, why do we have to assess the child? Then we move on to other developmental assessments that can be done by qualified people, so that not only should we divert these people or, you know, dismiss or discharge them, but we have to understand what is the long-term impact that's going to make in this child's life. so such a way that if we understand that it is developmental and it is a process, then we'll have to very define it even from the way it's conceptualized in the field.
Why are you not consistent with the research? JG, you want to come in on that?
My question was, there's a section in the bill, section 36, or clause 36, entitled purpose of assessment. Your submission was that that is too narrow. Okay. My question then is, what's missing? All right. Okay. So you know what you've come with is to say, okay, it's too narrow. Use the definition in the Probation Services Act. But I'm saying, why is section 36 too narrow? What is missing from it? Because I'm worried that even if we did put the definition of a probation officer from the Probation Services Act in the definition of this bill, is that going to address the problem? It seems to me if you say the purpose of clause 36 is too narrow, where are the omissions? What should be added?
Well, I suppose what I meant today is that the purpose of assessment is not cut out very well from the beginning part of this chapter one, in fact, of the bill. I thought it needed to be the purpose of it not captured by that definition of assessment. Perhaps I didn't make it quite clear there.
But say the very last one comes again. I mean, there's a section of clause called purpose of assessment.
Yes.
If you're unhappy with that, where are you unhappy? Please can you propose deletions, amendments to clause 36?
I had a look at the book that introduced and it's the same as we have here.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago. I'll try not to refer to the perhaps that was answered by saying, is it the appropriate thing to do to try and limit on the business in the definition? If there's something wrong with the purpose of the part you are saying there, and then we expect not to.
So you've got enough time. So just to call these amendments. Then we've got a hand up in the back there. You're fine.
Steve? The one comment on section 72, where the pre-sentence investigation report, I think that's a very valid comment, where we've got custodial children in custody, 4 weeks term, basically suggests it should be a bit longer in other cases, and I think we should look at that.
Yeah.
Maybe you could propose some wording on that.
I
think it's section 72 in the book, but it's very useful. Yeah.
Put the slide as well, because you made it too long.
Actually, note that in the request for us to provide some evidence around the coverage in relation to assessments and so on, would be not possible for us to provide to the department. If you could ask through the Department of Justice representatives here for the Department of Social Development to provide that.
It's about you are convinced it can be done. All of you are saying this for a regular time. So the department's coming out, you can't be done. So they're going to come here and give up the information. We'd like you to also come at the same time. Your two friends there, they will be here. We will give you the chance to respond to the department. But we can't have anything, you know. But yesterday we saw 10 people and then we want you to get the evidence. And this is a fairly open transparent society. Where you are not getting things that you want, can you raise it with me or Bulalani Madhwanisha? You see him, he's the second person there, he's the book of the commission. We will then find out from the minister what law is being used to prevent you having access to the information, and we'll take it as part of its work. Okay? Now let's move on then. Is there any other thing before we move on? We're a bit behind time. Thank you. The next person then is Professor Julia Slot Nielsen. Are you here? Go for it, please. Ah, the number is in your program. It says 12.
Thank you, Chair. I'd just like to introduce myself. I'm a professor at the Faculty of Law at the University of the Western Cape. I was previously the project manager of the Children's Rights Project at the Community Law Center, and I was a member of the project committee of the South African Law Reform Commission that drafted the Child Justice Service and introduced in 2002. So I've been working in the field for approximately 15 years, also at the practical level, running my own diversion project, conducting research, teaching juvenile justice, and a few other things like that, drafting UN documents, etc. I would like to just at the outset mention that I'm also involved in the drafting of the regulations to the Children's Act 38 of 2005. So I've been involved in that process as well. And I do not come without gifts. I have brought my new pamphlet on the Children's Act for distribution in the committee. I produced for the Western Cape Department of Social Services in the three languages of the Western Cape, being English, Afrikaans, and Xhosa. And I also have produced a video on the Children's Act, which the committee is welcome to have a copy of. It's about 32 minutes long. And although it doesn't deal directly with the issues and points, it's clearly complementary to the matter of children experiencing difficulties in their life. Thank you. So to confine my comments to four main areas, starting with probably the most contentious one, which is the question of the age of criminal capacity. And I have prepared a detailed submission, so I'm not going to detail the technical errors and inconsistencies and incorrect references that appear upon the section dealing with age of capacity. And I will proceed to discuss the substance of my contention, which is that when we as a project committee of the Law Commission boldly proposed raising the minimum age of criminal capacity to 10 years, which was something which was reflected on in considerable detail. We in fact convened an expert seminar for 2 days on the issue, drawing in religious leaders, cultural leaders, anthropologists, sociologists, international experts. But we did so on the premise that there would be a sufficient protection for children for whom the rebuttable presumption of incapacity would continue to apply. We were proud of our heritage, our legal heritage in this regard. We thought in 1997, 1998 now, and we thought that the rebuttable presumption had value. The proposal on the table, I am firmly convinced, lacked any of the safeguards that we had envisaged would remain. Also, the whole concept of the rebuttable presumption of incapacity has been completely overturned in all other jurisdictions where at the time it was current, for example, in the UK. And the Committee on the Rights of the Child, in its general comment number 10, which I believe the committee has been appraised of, and I have brought a copy with me for anyone who would like to see it, has now, through its extensive deliberations on country reports over the past 18 years, the convention is now 18 years old, concluded that 12 is the minimum permissible age in international law of criminal responsibility. I'd also like to draw the committee's attention to a document which I found on my desk this morning, which is a resolution of the United Nations Economic and Social Council of June 2007, which proposes that national efforts for child justice reform must comply with the United Nations minimum standards on the administration of juvenile justice, including the minimum age of criminal responsibility, as it is now widely known in international law, the MACR. And one of the countries, the four countries that proposed this resolution was South Africa. Turning to the formulation in the bill, I'd like to make two comments on the provisions related to children below the age of 10 years. The first is the very unfortunately worded clause 7, 3B, which provides that if any action taken under paragraph A may not in any way require the child to be held responsible for the incident. Now that seems a very unfortunate message to the general public, because it tells the general public that actually the child is not responsible, and this is not the intention of this particular provision. It's very clear in the international literature that what matters is not so much where you set the age of criminal responsibility, but what you do with children who fall below that age. And we have tended all along, and this was actually reinserted into the table version by the portfolio committee, this particular provision, that there should be mechanisms for dealing with children below the age of criminal responsibility in such a way that they in some other way can be held responsible for the incident. So I would ask that that please be reworded so as to not mislead the general public. Then again, I'm very confused by section subsection 4A, which requires the probation officers to assist more fully with circumstances surrounding allegations against the child under 10 who is alleged to have committed an act of serious consequences. Now, this is not a very well-known concept in conventional criminal law. You could have a plot to murder somebody which has not yet got any serious consequences, but it's pretty serious for the conspiracy to murder. And I'm confused as to what that actually means, and I suggest that it should be revisited. And then finally, in that particular subsection, the idea that after this non-judicial process is followed by a probation officer, the plan must then be submitted to a magistrate is highly perplexing. It means that it's actually a judicial process, and the poor magistrate will then have to decide what to do with this plan. If the magistrate must just rubber stamp it, then we really underestimate the cost of magistrate. If the magistrate is to be enabled or equipped to change the plan, then we need to say so. But that's overly bureaucratic and should be taken on. I'd like to also just draw the committee's attention, I do detail this in my submission, to one of the problems about, or one of the concerns about raising the minimum age of criminal capacity is that adults will use children to commit offences where they fall below that age. I would like to happily announce to the committee that that is no longer a problem for this portfolio committee, because a criminal offence, section 141, 1G, has been created in the final draft of the Children's Act Amendment Bill, 19th of 2006, which also renders the particular section, I think it's section 93 in this bill, unnecessary, because it is now a criminal offence to use children in the commission of an offence. That is any child, not just the child below the minimum age of criminal responsibility. And I want to again say MATR is the exception. I would also like to argue that in line with the Vienna Law of Treaties, the country, South Africa, should not legislate in a manner that is contrary to our international obligations derived from our ratification of the CRT. And as I say again, the international standard is now very clear that if there is to be a rebuttal presumption at all, which I dispute because of the fact that insufficient protection is provided, it's discretionary, prosecutors can decide now on a child's criminal capacity based on what they've learned from me in juvenile justice, not ever having seen a child, of course. And various other motivations that I have fully elaborated in my commission. So I turn to my second area of consideration, which is the area of sentencing. And here, and I guess my remarks going full well that Mr. Bloom is in the room, that prison is no place for a child aged under 14. I have been working in prison for 12 years. I run an NGO that works on the reform of prisons and assists the department with that process. I have given expert evidence in cases involving imprisonment of children, and I have visited many, many prisons in this country over the last 12 years, as well as writing a book on children in prisons. And I would therefore like to strongly motivate that the present position that children under 14 may not be detained in prison awaits the child be retained. South Africa has made great strides in reducing the number of children in detention over the years, and I think this is going to be a matter for international support when we finally get our report to the Committee on the Rights of the Child. And I would dare to suggest that since there are even fewer sentenced children in prison, it is possible for us to find alternatives for children aged under 14. And I draw the committee's attention to probably one of the most serious cases that has ever occurred before our Supreme Court of Appeal, in a case of premeditated murder planned and commissioned by a girl of 12 years old, in which the Supreme Court of Appeal confirmed a non-custodial sentence under conditions. We do not need to have children under 14 in prison. I also would like to draw the committee's attention to the unfortunate provision of Section 78(5) concerning a maximum length of 25 years imprisonment for a short first house. Now, I'm being very familiar at the moment with the whole section of parole, which I am involved with for the department. 25 years is the maximum sentence that any adult person would serve if sentenced to the most serious form of imprisonment, namely life imprisonment. You must be considered by the National Council on Correctional Services for a release of 25 years. This is the maximum period for an adult, so where is the discount for you if that is the maximum sentence for children? And further, experience and research, practical research since 1996 in the sphere of sentencing has shown that when you set a benchmark like that, as happened when the jurisdiction of the regional court was raised to 15 years, that becomes the sentencing tariff. And I can cite any number of very serious cases, particularly in the Western Cape in the recent past, where a child was co-accused with adults, where they received life sentences, and not one of those children received a 25-year sentence. And I've talked, for example, about the Valencia Pharma case, which people will maybe be familiar with. So I would propose that unless a realistic sentence which indicates the usefulness of the fact of discount for youthful age can be introduced, such as 10 years, or 15 years, or 3 years, as it is in Uganda, then please leave that provision out altogether, because it would act as a rag to the sentencing officer. Legal representation. This is an area in which I want to spend maybe another couple of minutes of children, and I would like to just contextualize the legal representation clauses within the fact that the whole environment around legal representation has changed very dramatically since the Law Commission was busy with our investigation. We did recognize this at the time and wrote this into the narrative, but we didn't know what was going to happen with the legal aid. But I'm very happy to report that matters have taken a very welcome turn in a number of respects, and that I was quite coincidentally asked to author a study of legal representation services to children in South Africa, which was completed on the 7th of December 2007, and I have a copy with me, and I rely on it extensively in my presentation. So this is now really quite up to date. It was obviously completed before the tabling of the bill. What the study shows is that between April and October last year, this was done with various service providers, including the private sector, the legal aid board and so forth, 25,000 children were provided with legal representation in criminal matters over a 7-month period, which is I think a very substantial number of children who benefited from legal aid services. The study records that there are now 60 justice centers. Each one has a children's unit staffed by a professional attorney with at least 5 years experience and assisted by a candidate attorney. Because of the expansion of services and the improvement of quality that has taken place over the last 10 years, the problems that gave rise to some of the provisions in the bill, that children didn't want to have a legal representative paid for by the state, or that they would prefer to represent themselves, or that they didn't trust their lawyer, those are rapidly diminishing. And most children who are offered free legal aid say they would like to have it, as they have corrected the negative positions they used to have in that regard. As regards the one-stop child justice centre currently in existence at Mangaung, at Marina and Elizabeth and at Fort Knowles, the legal aid board is very clear in its policy to have permanent representatives from the justice centres situated at one-stop centres to provide legal representation to all children appearing at those centres. What is the consequence of the study? I'm not going to go into it in detail. The consequence is that some of the provisions that are contained in the present child justice bill are unfortunately outdated. They no longer mesh with legal aid or policy, which has developed since the introduction of the original bill. For example, the question as to the criteria for granting legal aid in cases where substantial injustice might result. And I have explained all of this, so I'm not going to go into this in laborious detail here. Bill proposals are now less generous than the actual policy and practice of the legal aid board. They are granting legal aid to more people, to more children, for example, all 16 and 17 year olds in custody awaiting trial, than the bill actually proposes. So the bill is proposing a retrogressive step, and one which I argue is constitutionally suspect because it conflicts with the legal aid board's own manual. My proposal, I mean, this is unfortunate, right, yes, but obviously very fortunate for the child beneficiaries of legal representation of the other case. My submission is that the portfolio committee should be first guided by the policy of the legal aid board, and secondly, interface with the legal aid board to determine the criteria, if they are to be spelled out in more detail here, so that they mesh with the legal aid board policy. I do have a problem with the provisions that do not clearly state, as international law does, that a child must have the benefit or access to legal representation as of the commencement of the proceedings. Now, it must be so that the preliminary inquiry is a proceeding. After all, it's chaired by a magistrate and attended by a prosecutor. And to suggest that only legal representatives with permission to attend is flouting the Constitution. So you have the right to have your legal representatives at all proceedings, including pre-trial proceedings, like pointing out and taking down the Constitution. So the question of consent being obtained for about to attend the preliminary inquiry cannot hold water. Although I do argue in my submission that lawyers should not necessarily be present at assessment, and I believe that assessments need not be described as a judicial proceeding, given that it is an exploration of the circumstances by a probation officer. I also suggest that at least the references that were contained in the initial bill to the criteria for the awarding of legal representation of state expenses be re-examined. The question of specialization. Specialization is required by international law by the General Comment, and of course was highly supported by South Africa in its motivation to the UN Economic and Social Council last year, and I do believe that we tried to provide for some form of specialization in the initial bill by looking for a system of accreditation. Now, without having discussed this with anybody else, I don't think in the present developmental climate accreditation is going to be possible, given the structure that the legal aid board has decided upon, nor do I necessarily think it's necessary, since the board is itself proceeding with training and specialization as mentioned to the children's unit. However, I do think that it's important that there should be an encouragement of training and specialization, and I propose that there should be a provision empowering the cabinet minister responsible for the administration of justice to present every 5 years a national policy outlining the training and specialization in child justice that everybody who is involved in the system may benefit from, in the same way as, for example, the social work profession has to do in terms of training. As regards the proposal that where a child refuses legal representation, another person be appointed, and the reference to the rules of court in this regard, we can't really comment on what that person is going to do in court as the non-representative of the child unless we see the rules of court. So I would like to ask the portfolio committee to get in a member of the rules committee and see what they have to offer in that regard. The separation and joinder of files of accused, this is extremely weak in the present bill. It's not clear what happens when a child is co-accused with an adult. In practice, the different one-stop child justice centres are operating along different principles. Sometimes the adult goes to the one-stop centre, sometimes the adult doesn't. And I think that from the point of view of practice, far more clarity is needed. There's a very oblique mention in Rule 63 of a situation where a child might be co-accused with an adult. And I would like to point out that our research at the time revealed that I'm pretty convinced that it's no different today, that approximately 20 to 30% of all cases involve children co-accused with adults. And role players need to be given clear guidance. In line with the principle, the ideal of separation, and we did deliberate very carefully on this, there should be a presumption of separation, as was contained originally in Clause 57, one of the original rules, which does not mean that this is not a presumption that can be rebutted. We are mindful and were at the time of the difficulties of securing evidence, of securing convictions. This is supposed to facilitate the activities of role players and not make it more difficult for them. But I would submit that the lacuna, the absence of anything about separation of child, is going to be common. Lastly, I'd like to talk a little bit about data. I've been in the field a long time. My first juvenile justice workshop in 1994 was about correct statistics. In 2006, UNICEF, and there's a lot of international activity in this area, release the juvenile justice indicators, which are the 50 minimum things a country or a court or a province or a state has to know before it can start to say, are we doing anything at all, and are we doing it right, and are we going to do it better next year? And the one thing, the first one, is how many children are deprived of their liberty? And we still can't answer that question. We do not know how many children are arrested. We do not know how many children are in prison. Yet we have 53 million cell phone users in this country, which means every child under the age of 10 has a cell phone. This is it. We have to get the statistics right, and I would urge the committee to put this into the main legislation, that we have to know how many children we're dealing with. And I would furthermore like to say that the responsibility for this system information, number of convictions, number of prosecutions, must rest with the Police Department of Justice, as it does in the United States, as it does in Canada, as it does in all the other leading countries that have a juvenile justice system functioning.
Thank you. You took the full 25 minutes, but we'll engage with you. You also take on base, right? You just, we can engage with you.
But UWC.
Well, yeah, you take on base. Yes, Dennis Blue. And then
thank you very much. Thank you very much, Professor. It's a question of clarification. The step that Professor on the legal aid board and representation for children, juveniles, 2 weeks ago, I disputed that figure. I don't know where Professor did the figure. And I don't know if legal aid board lawyers are here or what. But out of 536 juvenile children under the age of 18 years downwards, 2 weeks ago, not a single one of them are having bail or bail of 200 rand. Not a single one of them know their lawyer, the name of the lawyer. So if you are saying, Professor, they are represented and whatever, I am saying 2 weeks ago, quickly, prison. Out of this 500, we interviewed them, and they are saying that they don't know the lawyer, they are represented by legal aid board, but they don't know the lawyer, there's no consultation. It's either they don't have bail, or the bail is 1,000 rand. So I just want clarity on that.
I think that overlaps also with a little falsehood, what you say.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Chair. I want to thank the Professor for a very well-prepared and thorough presentation. Yes, I would like some advice from her. If we increase the age for criminal capacity, what will be effect on civil liability? As it is in the moment with the age being 7, if my boy throws a stone through my neighbor's window, I'm not liable if he is under 7. If we put it up to 12, will the civil liability also be 12, or will it remain at 7?
Any further questions?
Yeah. Thank you. Just your concerns about the irrevocable presumption, the wording having been changed. Did you provide suggested wording? Should we to retain the protection that you said has been taken away in the new formulation? I don't think it is, but if you could give us that, that would be useful.
The General Observation Committee, yeah. Professor, you seem to be wanting to exclude the role of the magistrate, right, in a number of these procedures here. But whom do you think will be there, right? I mean, the guardian of the child is in the court, anyway. But why do we exclude it?
I'll come to the fifth question last. The statistics that we got were from the legal aid group themselves about the number of cases in which they were appearing. What you're highlighting is the need for quality legal representation, which is also our concern. But what that needs to be addressed at obviously at the level of the legal aid board, is employees, training, which is why I made the proposal that we do need to further specialisation. We must accept that we've come a long way in the last 10 years, but we do need to legislate for ongoing in-service training to ensure that employees are exposed to, as Justice College has also been doing for the last 10 years. I've been doing training for magistrates all over the country. And every three months they have a course on trial law for magistrates. And this has led to a huge increase in knowledge and capacity. So that's that level that we need to improve legal services for children so that lawyers introduce themselves so the children know their names so that they are able to motivate clearly their clients taking their course. But I do stand by the statistics. As regards civil liability, I don't believe that there would be any effect on the common law. I was informed by my Felix advisor on the side here, because I know nothing about Felix. But it really doesn't have to do with fault. In the same way, you can be held liable for your pet biting somebody, even though the poor pet can't be prosecuted. I don't believe that raising the age of criminal responsibility would have any consequence for the literal liability. The irrevocable presumption, if it is to remain, it would be an anachronism in the world today, I have to say this, which was not the time the case 10 years ago. And according to the Committee on the Rights of the Child and general comment, clearly results in discrimination because if they factor, you're treating children of different ages differently and de jure, you're doing the same thing. But if you are to retain it, what is absolutely missing is the requirement that before a child lands up in court that that child's criminal capacity is properly established by a suitably qualified expert at state expense. In the same way, if you have a system where if you say, I'm mad, you have to be assessed by a psychiatrist and it has to be shown, you can't just ignore this allegation, that the person is in fact either able to or not able to comprehend the wrongfulness of his or her act and the circumstances of the child. And it's both of those things that have to be present before criminal capacity is present. Not only with the person who was there doing, but also they can brief counsel, that they can understand the cross-examination, that they can participate in the hearing. So it's not a question of the wording of the rebuttable presumption, it's a question of the support that goes in place to ensuring that it is dealt with seriously, that it actually serves as some kind of protection, and that there's a proper evaluation before court. That is not an evaluation that is done as an assessment by a probation officer. It is an assessment of somebody with expertise in the cognitive and cognitive developmental functions and who's got the time to sit and talk to a child about something other than the offence and where the parents are and what happened and so on and so forth, and to delve into capacity in a much more fundamental way. That it needs to be at stake expense is obvious, because otherwise one is legislating for exclusion for children who can't afford those services. We would never dream of doing that if it was a patient who was alleging mental incapacity as an adult, that they would have to go and pay for their own private costs. And then the last question about the role of magistrates. I think one of the interesting developments in child justice in South Africa has been the fact that at an early point the decision was made to place all of the emphasis on magistrates, hence the development of the preliminary inquiry procedure which places the magistrate at the sentencing. And in 10 years hindsight, I have still maintained that that was actually a very clever decision to make, because we have trained so many magistrates because they have taken on that role and they see themselves as the champions of child justice. But where we have decided not to take a child into the justice system, where that child is under 10, then I don't believe that magistrates are properly involved in that system at all. Then we are taking them out of the system and saying this is a social welfare case, this is a case for a probation officer. I can't see the point of involving magistrates. I think it's unnecessary.
A practical example, for example, and you are suggesting that we take out, for example, you know, or 7, right, yeah, 7. But the magistrates don't make the assessment of the probation officer and the recommendation or the court. It's a simple, simple procedure, which then enhance actually the work of the probation officer. And the system has cut it out.
What is the magistrate supposed to do with the fact? The child isn't before the court. She's not in the justice. The child lacks criminal responsibility. Is it just the filing cabinet for the probation officer? Or can the magistrate do something with the plan? Change it. Say it's not good enough. Or the language is poor. Or I don't like the outcome you believe on. This is to me not at all clear.
The idea in order of the court gives you the bit of the more powerful to execute his finding.
Fine, you can use the tea, just very quickly, we don't need a 15 minutes of a tea. Can't we just get our tea and coffee and whatever and come back? Because we're well behind time and we might
that's the program that we
just got. I have with me Ms. Jackie Gadamisi, who says that the code is anything and addressing you on the second issue that we addressed in our submission. Now, our submission basically focuses on two aspects, the first being sort of the detention of children under 14 years awaiting trial in prison, as well as the sentenced children, and the second being the youth of children.
Catholic prison sponsors are you here? Can you take on them? And then Kevin, Russell, is that are you take on them? Okay, so there's no flight issue.
What I was saying is that the second issue we would like to address is the use of children in the commission of the use of children by adults to commit crime, which was briefly alluded to yesterday by the Department of Justice as well as Professor Julia Scott Nielsen in her presentation earlier. So we know that the committee is trying to catch up on time, so we're going to repeat too much of what was said by Professor Julia Scott Nielsen as well as the presenters yesterday. But just with regard to the detention of children in prison, I wish to point out that international law, as well as our constitution, in section 28.1g, is clear that the detention of children, as we have constantly heard during the deliberations yesterday, should only be as a measure of last resort and for the shortest possible period of time. But in addition to that, international law also specifically places a strong emphasis on restricting the use of imprisonment of children. And this is reflected in Article 37B of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, as well as in Rule 1 of the United Nations Rules for the Protection of Juveniles Deprived of Their Liberty. This then places an obligation on state parties to draft legislation that would give effect to imprisonment of children as a last resort and for the shortest possible period of time. At this point, I'd just like to mention that the Department of Correctional Services' white paper on corrections in South Africa 2005 states clearly that children should not be in correctional sentences and should as far as possible be diverted from the criminal justice system. Where this is not an option, they should be accommodated in secure care facilities that are designed for children, and that children under the age of 14 have no place in correctional centres. As I stated earlier, the submission addresses the detention of children under the age of 14 in prison, either awaiting trial or as sentenced children. Now, with regard to the detention of children under the age of 14 in prison awaiting trial, I wish to point out that the present law, in the form of Section 49 of the Correctional Services Act, prohibits the detention of such children awaiting trial in prison. This provision, following an earlier initial amendment in 1994 that prohibited the pretrial detention of all children, was enacted in the mid-1990s when the situation of children in prison was under intense focus, and prisons were seen as unsuitable for children, and that rather more humane, welfare institutions such as places of safety and secure care facilities were envisaged for children who required secure care while awaiting trial. Now, it should be noted that the 2002 version of the Child Justice Bill did in fact prohibit the pre-trial detention of children under 14 years in prison. This approach thereby confirmed the current law as containing Section 29 of the Correctional Services Act. It reiterated the principle of detention as a measure of last resort, and also that prison is not suitable for children. It is therefore of great concern that the current version of the bill, in Clause 50, Subsection 2, allows for children under the age of 14, charged with certain offences, to be held in prison awaiting trial. We submit that this is a retrogressive step, as our present law forbids such detention of children. Further, it must be noted that this category of children, meaning children aged 10, 11, 12, and 13, are rebuttably presumed to lack criminal capacity, and so to place them in a prison awaiting trial exposes these most vulnerable children, as they may not be found to be criminally responsible, to inappropriate and dangerous detention. We therefore submit that it is not in the best interest of these children to be held in prison awaiting trial, and that if need be, they should instead be detained in places of safety or secure care facilities, soon to be renamed Child and Youth Care Centres in terms of the Children's Act such as 2005. Given the young age, the fact that they are rebuttably presumed to lack criminal capacity, the prevailing law and policy that currently excludes the detention of such children in prison, the fact that the Department of Correctional Services does not offer educational services to these children, and the fact that recent statistics revealed yesterday by the CSTRI reflected that 560 bed spaces were available in secure camp places of safety, thus meaning that their full capacity is not being utilized at the moment. We therefore submit that clause 50 subsection 2 be removed from the bill, and that it be redrafted to say that only children 14 years and above can be detained in prison awaiting trial. Now, with regard to the sentencing of children under 14 years of prison, we recognize that the 2002 version of the bill in clause 69, subsection 1, subsection A, recognized the vulnerability of these young children, and that imprisonment was not an appropriate sentence for children, for them, thereby prohibiting imprisonment as a sentence. But the 2007 version currently before this committee allows for such children to be sentenced to prison. Now, without repeating what Carol mentioned earlier today, that recent statistics reveal that only 3 children under the age of 14 were currently serving sentences in prison sentences, and without repeating what Professor Julia Stock-Nielsen said, that the 12-year-old girl who was convicted for premeditated murder was actually a very innovative sentence was imposed on her but kept her out of prison. We submit that it is not in the best interest of children under this age to be sentenced to prison, and therefore we recommend that clause 78 of the subsection 1 of the bill be amended to reflect that only children over the age of 14 years be sentenced to prison. I'm now going to hand over to Ms. Gallinetti, who is going to address you on children and youth adults in the Crown. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Just very, very briefly. Children used by adults to commit crime, as Professor Stock-Nielsen said, is now a criminal offence in terms of the Children's Act, the Children's Amendment Bill, 19F. The issue of children used by adults to commit crime is addressed specifically in international law by the ILO Convention 182 on worst forms of child labour, and it's seen as an issue of worst forms of child labour. Therefore, a child who commits a crime having been used by an adult is not only a perpetrator, but is also a victim of exploitation. And we cannot lose sight of the fact that certain children, therefore, who come into contact with law and the criminal justice system, have a dual status. They're not only perpetrators who are responsible for their actions, but they're also victims of the hands of exploitation of adults. And the reason that I raise this is that, and again, and I hope I don't sound like a track record from all the other organisations, is that I just want to emphasise, therefore, that the procedures that were contained in the 2002 version of the bill are eminently suitable to deal with these kinds of children. If you have a proper assessment process, you will be able to identify a child who has been used by an adult to commit crime, and therefore put systems in place to remove that child from such exploitation and give him or her possibly avenues for either withdrawing him from such a situation or being able to prevent being used, him or her from being used again. Likewise, the preliminary inquiry can be used for certain decisions in relation to that child. And so too, children who have been used by adults to commit crime should also, in respect of all offences, be able to be considered for diversion, because diversion programs can assist children in learning skills so as to resist such exploitation in future. So that's the one way in which the child justice law can assist children who are not only perpetrators but victims. The other way, also briefly alluded to by Professor Stock-Nielsen, is in relation to the issue of separation and joinder. The previous version of the child justice law had the presumption that all trials where there's a co-accused with an adult should proceed separately to the trial of the child. Research has been conducted in relation to children used by adults to commit crime, and children consistently indicate that they are intimidated by adults who use them. Although it's not a given that an adult co-accused had used that child to commit the crime, I would say that there is a very high risk that there was some form of exploitation involved where an adult is co-accused with a child. Therefore, I think it is imperative that the trials are separate and that they do not, that they are not joined in the criminal justice process because of this high risk that there is some form of exploitation by the adult with the child, and that they should
proceed separately, so the child feels free to properly engage with the criminal justice process. And in that respect, we will therefore request and submit that the previous provisions relating to separation and joinder be reinserted into the bill. Thank you.
Okay, the question, please. There's a considerable overlap, I think, I mean, there are about 6 million questions I could ask, but, you know, I don't think we can engage with you all the time.
You see, what do you need to do?
Just
from a procedural point of view, I mean, this is community law centre. Then the next one is Child Justice Alliance, which the two presenters also wrote that. I'm not sure why. I know that it's different organisations, but would it not be better to have both submissions and then we ask them questions?
Yeah.
Thank you. If I could just
I know why. I mean, the Alliance is a broader umbrella body. Community Law Centre is a specific organisation. So I know they're different. So I'm just sort of saying, if it's going to be both of them, both of you presenting for the Alliance, why don't you do that one too, and then we ask you all the questions.
Okay, no, that's great. Thank you. I will. My submission for the Child Justice Alliance is also going to be very brief. We have made a very lengthy submission, a written submission, where we've gone through, hopefully, clause by clause, each part of the bill. And we've made submissions not only on substantive issues that have been raised by other organizations, but we've also made certain submissions regarding typographical and cross-referencing problems that we picked up, and also then made certain suggestions given our substantive submissions for how the bill can be changed and perhaps simplified in certain respects. So I would refer you to that submission. To start, I would wish to welcome, to thank the committee for placing this issue back on the agenda of Child Justice Law. We welcome its reintroduction into Parliament because we believe that, at least, a lot of the submissions here today have been, could perhaps be seen as critical of the content of the bill. But ultimately, our position is that we welcome the Child Justice Bill as creating a separate criminal justice system for children, which we do think is necessary and high time that South Africa finally adopts one. So even though there are certain aspects of the bill that we are concerned with, the bill as a whole, we are extremely encouraged that it's back in Parliament. And that the ethos of the bill as it was introduced into Parliament in 2002 remains. We still have assessment for children. We still have diversion. We still have all the beneficial aspects of that bill in the present version of the bill. Granted, we do, and one of our overarching concerns is the fact that it does exclude certain children from the benefits of these procedures, but I think that's been dealt with quite sufficiently by other presenters, and it is also dealt with in our written submission. I just want to perhaps deal with some issues regarding implementation, which the committee has highlighted. At the outset, I would like to give a caveat that as civil society, it is quite difficult for us to talk to the issue of implementation of the bill. One of the reasons being is that we're not going to be the implementers. But on the other hand, I do want to say that civil society works very closely with government and that we do cooperate in a number of respects. And therefore, I think that the submissions that we have made, for example, in relation to assessment, that there be another suitably qualified person to assist with assessment, is a reasonable submission, given our knowledge of what is happening in government. Also, given the fact of the idea of assessment. So, for example, the initial assessment, where we're talking about this suitably qualified person, that is that information gathering process within the first 48 hours. If there needs to be, and the concern was raised that this person might not be suitably trained to do an in-depth and complex assessment, there are provisions within the preliminary inquiry chapter in Clause 49 which allows for an ongoing process of assessment by a more experienced a person with specific aims of looking at, for example, the complexity of the matter if it's a sexual offence or if it involves a repeat offender. So there are processes, there is flexibility within the bill to accommodate more suitably qualified people just for that initial information gathering assessment and then the use of more expert assessors later in the process. Secondly, in relation to diversion, I would just like to point out that most of the diversion service providers in South Africa today are civil society organizations. The Department of Social Development does offer a number of diversion services, but generally what they do is they contract out diversion services to a number of organizations. You heard from the Restorative Justice Center yesterday, NICRA will be coming next week. There's also CODISA, who's also involved quite prolifically in various provinces. And although we do recognize that statistics are problematic and that they sometimes there's a lack of reliable statistics that we can't quite present as truly indicative of the whole picture or the whole trend. What we do know is that the National Prosecuting Authority has consistently produced statistics of more diversions each year, which goes to show that there is capacity for more diversions to occur on an ongoing basis. So I don't think that the lack of diversion service providers presents an insurmountable problem. Likewise, there's also provisions in the bill which allows for an innovative solution for diversion, which doesn't necessarily require a programmatic response, and that the minimum standards also deals with those types of situations that the minimum standards that the Department of Social Development has presented. Then, just to address perhaps the implementation by the department, which I don't, I'm not speaking for them, but I am speaking from the position of having been there, and I'm sure some of the other committee members were here in 2003. And in 2003, a full implementation plan was presented by all the departments. Now, I know that was 5 years ago, but at that stage, they said they were ready to implement the Child Justice Law. And the question, therefore, that arises is, if they were ready then, why are they not ready now? We know for certain that they have increased the number of posts of probation officers over the last 5 years. They've also increased the number of assistant probation officers. They've rolled out reception, arrest, and referral centers across the country. And they've also increased the number of security facilities. So I would say that they're actually possibly in a better position now than they were in 2003. Likewise, other departments who also came to Parliament and said that they had implementation plans ready and they had budgets ready. Now, my point is that at that stage, this implementation plan was worked on for 2 years. So the bill went to the Department of Justice in 2000 and that was introduced in 2002. So there was a long planning process of 2 years where this implementation plan was developed. I would suggest to the committee that they possibly investigate with the department as to whether or not that implementation plan could not form the basis for the ongoing implementation, although the development of an implementation plan for this version of the Child Justice Law. The work has been done, it can present a template, and then just be updated with new information, what is available at the moment and possible, the updating of budgets and planning for rollout. So those would be as practical suggestions as I can possibly make at this stage, and we'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank them for the incredible submission to be working to. There's a lot of good input there that we will be considering.
I suppose it's more the I'm mixing up the two positions if you don't mind, but the issue of the sentencing, the ban, if you want, on sentencing children under 14 to prison. And, I mean, from a public point of view, if you have, I mean, sure, you could have very few children under the age of 14 being sentenced, as it is already, to term of prison. But, you know, if you provide a blanket ban and you have then a case that grabs the public imagination, and you may have a problem of a particularly violent 13-year-old, for which there is no secure care facility for them to be put into without escaping or something like that. That ban would stop you putting them in prison. And the difficulty I think we would face having to bear the brunt of public opinion is that the public demand would be for that kind of hypothetical case to go to prison. So that's the sort of one difficulty. I mean, it's fine, the general statistics, the majority of cases, etc., but we have to deal with the one case that grabs the headlines. So just that is a sort of comment, I suppose, more, not really to respond to it that much. I mean, I think in the Peter Maritzburg case, you know, it was good that the Appendix Division of Supreme Court of Appeal upheld that case, but that was a specific set of circumstances. A person, a child in a relationship who then hired somebody to kill her grandmother. But you can sort of accept that you probably wouldn't do it again. But you could have a child with more broader anger, more broader violence society needs to be protected from. So just that is a comment really. The age of capacity again, I think we've got is that we're the bill is proposing moving it from 30 to 10, which is a 3-year advance. Okay, I think the request for 12 or 14. Is the public going to accept that? As was said yesterday, I think South America is 16 or 18, but Brazil is the place, I think, where they vigilantly murder street kids, because those vigilantes or those elements of society feel that what the law is saying, we don't want that situation here. So I think, I mean, in one case that nobody's really spoken about, and I'm going to put more information on, the James Balder case in Britain. I mean, I'm not sure what the age of capacity is in Britain. I'm not sure that chair was the one where the toddler, Balder, was killed by some other kids and allegedly recreating something in a video game. Now, how old are those kids? I think they got released a couple of years ago, but I mean, what's the analysis of that case? But the difficulty is, you know, as I said, it goes back to the point, the statistics, everything could point out to there being very few cases where children need to be put in prison. But you have that one case that grabs the attention, and the response from the public then, or elements of the public, is an outcry, is enormous criticism, and it's even the delight of you.
I mean, if I'm not taking into consideration, you know, it is only, and it might be very, rare among children, right? For really very, very, among the very serious cases we have, you know, in the schedule. And I think one is taking into consideration also that can one expose such a child to other children in a secure sex sense? That has been considered also.
Thank you. You ask very difficult questions, and they are hard questions.
I'm not going to deny that. But the thing is, those cases, as you said, are very rare. And when they do occur, and I take your point about the DCP versus P case, as well as exceptional circumstances, the chances that you'll commit that crime again are very, very low. Oh, sorry, rare. But then we've also had some other high-profile cases in the media. For example, the Clover Boy. Now, I know that the one Clover Boy, the case has been withdrawn against because of the fact that he potentially lacks criminal capacity. Likewise, you also have the situation of a couple of years ago in the Western case, there was five young boys who were charged with alleged to have committed really horrific offences. Basically, they went on a spree that was alleged from the Saturday to the Sunday, where they killed a number of protected bucks, and we're not talking about one or two, because of about 17. They beat them to death, allegedly. And in the process, one of their, and we're talking about 8, 9, and 12 year olds, 5 of them. And they also proceeded then to, when a friend of theirs was going to go and tell the farmer that they had done this, they repeatedly sodomized him with an instrument and tied him to a tree and left him for dead. So they were also charged with attempted murder. So that's a particularly heinous offense. In that instance as well, the state withdrew the case, referred it to the children's court to see that they get some kind of intervention. Now, my point is, and I take your point about them being very serious and violent offenders, but I also believe that those types of children, the system at present recognizes that they actually need something more than what prison can offer them. If we are not going to keep those children, they get minimum sentence of life imprisonment, which they won't because they're not a 16 or 17 year old. Even if they got 25 years, they'd be out in the middle of their 50s. There are no appropriate programs in prison to deal with these young children. They are going to come out of the city and potentially go and do exactly the same, only worse, because of all their experience that they then got in prison, thanks to having been placed in prison in the first place. So my point is why even open up that possibility to that? Let's make the system channel their energies on these young children in a way that can have a positive outcome for them and also a positive outcome for society. We're not saying that this is for all children. We're saying that this is for 10, 11, 12, and 13-year-old children, who the law at present says we don't even know if they're criminally responsible. So it's a very, very difficult situation, but I would say rather than being punitive, let's rather be protective. And just to say that the statistics, those three children, one is a sexual offence and two are economic offences that are in prison serving sentences. Now, economic sentences, there's no element of violence whatsoever. Why allow a magistrate, give the magistrate the option of still being able to impose the sentence on children who not, your intention, sorry, I'm not being particularly eloquent, your intention is that that just be for those really exceptional cases. But how do you legislate for those really exceptional cases? Murder is murder. How do you say, well, killing a child with a knife, or with a knife wound, stabbing, is less murderous than a child beating another child to death or torturing another child to death? How are you going to differentiate between the degrees of murder, so to speak? Because from what I understand is that you're looking for only those most heinous and the daily bulge of cases. Those are just my problems. Rather protect all children because, and this is my other point, and I know I'm going on a bit more, is that reform schools, security facilities, still offer a residential component for those children. And they offer programs that are designed for children, unlike prison, particularly those children under 14. And just to answer your question as well, is that we have in reform schools 16 and 17 year olds who are charged with murder. So a 12 or a 13 year old child who might be sentenced to a reform school doesn't necessarily mean that there are other children there who have committed less serious offences. That the reform schools are for the more serious type offences that children do commit for attention. I know I haven't been particularly eloquent about this because it is quite a difficult issue, but I do hope that I have made the point that it's very difficult to say let's just allow for it, because first of all, courts are reluctant to do it, and secondly, you're just gonna create a situation where the children that need the most intervention are going to go to a place that can offer them the least intervention.
You know, we will engage further, and we'll get another opportunity to follow that out there. But we look at it, not at you, it's something for what you say. So whether you write it down, or whether you want another week to say it, it's really not in the end. But we should also give you time to work through with your colleagues a fuller reply if you want. Right, so thank you very much to you two. Did Catholic Bishop's Conference go next? Wait a week. You're
Mike Papier, is that okay? That's correct, yes, thank you. Mike Papier. I'm the Director of Research for the Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Office. I'm also an advocate in private practice and obviously working in criminal law, so I may take one hat off briefly and put the other hat on during the course of my submission. Firstly, let's say, and I think I repeat here what many other submitters have said, that it's good to see this bill coming before Parliament again. Parliament has done quite a lot recently in the form of the Children's Act itself and certain other statutes to improve the situation of our children. This is an important leg of that platform. Having said that, though, it also causes great concern that the bill has been away for so long. We were here making submissions on it 5 years ago. And what happened? If I may just contrast it to what one reads about the intention to bring legislation before this committee and ultimately before Parliament to disband the Scorpions, and that this must happen before June. Why such urgency? And let me say the Church takes absolutely no position whatsoever on the disbandment otherwise of the Scorpions. But if such a thing can be brought with such enormous urgency, surely the rights of our children are of a different order entirely, and yet years have gone by. That calls for great concern, and we would hope that your committee will convey that to the powers that be. Nevertheless, we welcome the bill. We very much support the object of the bill, and in particular those of Thank you, Chairperson. I'm not going to pursue that point at all. As I was saying, we welcome the object of the act, and in particular, the intention to divert children as far as possible away and out of the criminal justice system. I think that's something which, again, many speakers have referred to, and we would like to endorse that very, very strongly. And again, the intention to promote cooperation between government departments and other organizations. We know simply from looking at the list of presenters here and the great work done by civil society organizations around the Children's Act, just how many there are and what great expertise they have in work to do with children. We would ask that the committee give attention to methods of actually stipulating as far as possible in the various sections of the statute ways in which government departments should cooperate or should bring in the resources available to them from civil society. It's one thing to have that intention, and that's laudable, but one would want to see perhaps more practical methods discussed in the statute to make it happen. Just a couple of general concerns and then one or two specific ones. Firstly, reading through the bill as it stands is a bit of a task. It is dealing with some very complicated material, but I do suggest that it could be drafted in a far more friendly manner. There's a lot of ways in which the language could just be simplified and made much easier to understand. And this is particularly important if we consider who's going to have to deal with this
sector. Some of the jobs substantially yesterday, what we'd really like from you to play some role, we'll come back to you and I'll be thinking about the simplified. I think the entire committee agrees that we have a meeting and we can move on.
Okay. The next concern I suspect has probably also been covered, but let me mention it for the record, and that is, are there going to be sufficient resources, particularly in the area of probation officers, to make this thing work? That's a great concern. There are not enough probation officers to serve the courts as things stand at the moment, as I think we all know. So one would want to know what steps the executive is planning to take to provide the necessary resources. Otherwise, this thing's going to fall flat.
Okay, so
just on
a point of order, sorry to interrupt. Which submission are we dealing with? The program says 21, but for the submissions in the Catholic Institute of Education, which is March 18, is that the one we're dealing with, or is that coming separately?
No, this is 21 Catholic Bishop Conference.
Okay.
Have you
got copies? No. Go ahead, Mr.
A specific concern relates to legal representation. Again, I don't know if it's been covered, but it seems to be unfortunate that it's almost an optional thing. Where children are concerned, one wants to see compulsory legal representation, and not just as it is set up, I think, in Clause 81 or so, that if the child is under the age of 14 or under the age of 16 and in prison and so on. One can think of no sound reason why there should not be a stipulation that there be legal representation if a child is coming into conflict with the law like this. To leave it up to the legal aid board to decide is again with respect to the risky. The legal aid board again is dreadfully unreliable. So we would want to see that one tightened up as well. And then, well, this again I think is not something where the church as such has any competence to speak, but if I may, as a criminal lawyer, I'd be concerned about the way in which in the preliminary inquiry, where a child makes an admission of responsibility, that later on in the process, if the child then fails to comply with the various provisions of orders and so on, the thing comes into a trial situation. That admission of responsibility is then regarded as a Section 220 formal admission. I would have personal doubts whether that's a constitutional provision at all. We have an informal inquisitorial investigation going on under a magistrate, which can take place in chambers without legal representation, where the child might be assisted only by its parents, who may be, again, with respect, ignorant of these things entirely. Child makes an admission. That can surely never stand as a formal admission just like that, with nothing further. And that, again, is the kind of thing which, I repeat myself with respect, has perhaps not been clearly thought through in the statute. Just how far do we want to go to divert children out of the criminal justice system? That provision brings them straight back and almost throws the book at them. You said that to the magistrate, we're going to hold you to it now. That can't work. There's got to be more flexibility and more provision made for the fact that these are children that we are dealing with. A final specific concern, and I know that the question of criminal capacity has been dealt with at great length, and I'm not going to repeat anything that was said there. But what appears to be a small and almost unimportant and insignificant question is this thing of transport. It's all very well to have separate proceedings for the children and to keep children in separate facilities and so on, but we know again from ordinary everyday experience just what can happen in that simple time, which can be a matter of minutes, perhaps a matter of hours, when people are being transported to and fro. And the relevant clause, 54, I think it is, stipulates that if at all possible, the children should be transported separately. Now, once again, that seems to undermine the whole thing. It creates that kind of crack in the door which can effectively undo all the good work. One has seen children arriving at court intimidated, having been attacked, having been abused in various ways, not in prison, and not in the court cell, but in the truck on the way there. It's a small thing, Mr. Chairperson, but one we want to see again that sort of thing tightened up. So those are our broad submissions. Once again, to reiterate, we welcome this and we urge the committee to process it as quickly as possible. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for the submission. Mike, would you just elucidate a bit further on your experience with the lack of probation officers and the legal aid board? You did indicate that you do capacity restraints. Have you contact? Have you experienced that yourself in, as a practicing lawyer?
I think at the moment, if you're looking for example, a pre-sentencing report from a probation officer in the High Court anyway, the waiting period is about 6 to 8 weeks. And then, when you get the report, often it is unfortunately quite superficial. And that's not because the probation officers are not competent and because they're not dedicated, it's simply because they have far too many cases for any trained person to be able to handle. They do their best. But they end up not being able to consult widely enough. They travel out to the prison, they travel out to see the family, and if the person is not available, they don't have the time to go and go on repeat visits. So, I think most practitioners would say that with the best will in the world, the probation officers are not able to supply the service that they would like to supply that the courts need. This statute requires an enormous amount of input from the probation officers, the assessments and the background work and so on, the attendance, that part of the inquiry. It's hugely time-consuming. The legal aid board, well, similarly, the board is beset by various problems. On the one hand, it lacks sufficient personnel of its own. It probably also lacks sufficient budget to pay for the judicare facility. But the problem in that regard is that the legal aid board approaches the decision about whether or not to supply legal representation according to a certain set of priorities, and one would be a bit concerned that when there's some sort of preliminary inquiry going on, and when it looks inevitably like the child is not going to end up in jail, but will face some other consequence, that again, with the best will in the world, having to prioritize, the board may find itself in a position where it cannot supply legal representation. So it prioritizes representation for what is perceived to be more serious needs. So that's another area of resources that one would want to see addressed. Whether it's addressed through this statute or through the Legal Aid Act itself would be another question.
It wasn't actually covered in the submission, but just your comments on the whole capacity question, legal capacity. what's your view on that? And it's also, look, I must indicate, I see in the next submission, which is for the Catholic Institute of Education, there's a submission that's opposition to raising capacity from 7 to 10. At Catholic Bishops Conference, what's your view on the capacity?
We always have to be careful to not to go into areas where we're not particularly competent. The Catholic Church is not made up of psychologists, it's certainly not a child psychologist. And before anyone else says it, and I know how many may be thinking it, Catholic Church has had some terribly unfortunate experiences, at least to see with children as well. So we have a lot of soul searching and reflection to be doing on such topics. I think the general tenor would be that as we advance in our understanding of human development and psychological development, we are going to always increase the age at which we start to call people to their responsibilities. In previous centuries, very, very young children were routinely in prison, and it wasn't just because those were unenlightened and sort of barbaric crimes. There was an understanding that you became responsible at a very young age. You went out to work if necessary at a very young age and so on. We're moving along from that sort of thing. One has to look at the common law presumptions of 7 and 14 and question them. And I think we would quite simply bow to the experts in that field. The experts in that field seem to suggest that we need to be increasing those ages. And I think we would, in general, go along with that. We're not in a position to take a firm position, as we're not experts on it.
Okay, can I just ask you a quick question about the passport issues raised? What's your response, though? There about the transport, about the abuse while the child is being taken from a prison or residential facility to the court or to a preliminary inquiry or what is that right?
Yeah, it's at clause 34.2c, where a child is transported to a court preliminary inquiry or child has to support the child must, if reasonably possible, be transported separately from adults. Sort of push that around, it'll be unless it's completely impossible.
What is the word that was suggested? I've missed that again.
You see, instead of reasonably possible, it gives a bit of latitude. Yeah. He's saying unless it's exceptionally difficult. You know, I don't know the word, but you're lawyers who look after it. Except in exceptional circumstances, then they will.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah, I mean, there's a power mic, but I think. Practical, yeah, we'll have to look at those things, yeah, we'll have to get some evidence before
which is mentioned here.
Again, we'll find in principle and values and rules, I mean, we disagree with many things said. We can't disagree, I don't mean a band-aid for this. We're a national democratic movement. There's no choice about it. If you like, we social democrats, you can't find this jargon for you. We have no choice. We'll have to agree with you. I don't need to consult with a study group about non-racialism and non-sexism. Similarly on children. I don't need to consult with this category.
Particularly in the board sets as well.
You know, being in the organization, we are sort of agree with any of the things we say. It's about how much we can implement right now in the book. That's the main issue now. I mean, we're not questioning the broad values that are underpinning what you're saying. On the legally important, let me assure you, we didn't see on the time with that. And we are meeting with the department in late March to take forward issues and as a department, yeah, okay, for the rest, I think we'll pass. Can we move on to the last submission, which is from Kevin, is that time for you?
Thank you, Chair. It's been a long 2 days, so I'll keep it as brief as possible and not raise any of the issues that have come before you already. But to just raise some 3 or 4 general kind of observations. The one is this bill intends to be effectively the Criminal Procedures Act for children. the fact that it makes references to parts of the criminal proceedings act as it stands now is slightly worrying, because it makes it subordinate legislation to other legislation. You either come up with a position where you say this is how we're going to deal with children in terms of criminal procedure and amend the current criminal procedures act, or you say this is just an extension to it. I'm not quite sure what the intention of Parliament is right now in that respect, because it ties into the questions of around the Children's Act and the new definitions and new principles that have come into place around very significant things like the best interest of the child principle. If we're going to make this subordinate to definitions of the Criminal Procedure Act in rather significant places, it runs the risk of causing a lot more confusion than is necessary. Another general observation is that often in parts of the bill, the best interest of the child is put up against other interests. So you'll have a term, the best interest of the child and the interest of justice, in a sentence. Quite simply, constitutionally, the best interest of the child is paramount. And there can be no other guiding principle but the best interest of the child. But, you know, you can obviously put that in, but it should be quite clear that it's not an either-or situation. The one is definitely, at least constitutionally, more respected. We raised a concern about the workload of the probation officer. I think it's been said quite a bit. And what's very worrying about it is, especially on the assessment section in 7.3a.6, where one of the options for the probation officer is to do nothing, that's a very worrying escape clause, considering all the other things that go around what a probation officer has to do. It would be a very simple for him to do nothing in terms of that clause and avoid doing all the other work. There's also a tendency for some things to come before Parliament. I'm not sure what the intention behind that was, but there's a certain case where programs, diversion programs, would have to be tabled in Parliament, the language that's used. I'm not quite sure if they mean that every diversion program will come to this committee and a bill will be put before Parliament and all the other procedures, or if quite simply the department will be drafting regulations which this committee through its oversight will be looking at. I think the language needs to be cleared up rather than creating administrative burdens where they're not meant to be created. I've mentioned the Children's Act, and I think, as everybody has said, we welcome bringing this bill back, and it comes in at a time where a lot does depend on the Children's Act and those new definitions, so somehow there has to be a rationalization between the two, and I think there's quite a significant departure at this point in time. There's also in the Act a definition of children in five sort of categories. There's children under 10, children 10 to 14, children 14 to 18, then there's the category of 16 to 18, and in some cases 18 to 21. So we're not really dealing with one clear definition of child, which causes a lot of problems with the different sort of things that apply to it. So the option to this committee and to the drafters is either to define all these five categories as different and everything that applies to them, as they did with children under 10, or to tighten that up and make it a fewer categories. There's also a certain language that I think needs to be cleared up, using terms like the cabinet member responsible for education. Can be any creative lawyer could drag a few ministers into court under that basis, but you just say the Minister of Education, if that's the department that will be doing it. I know we're all very keen on having interdepartmental cooperation and all those other things, but in reality budgets work in a certain way, and if we're going to take those responsibilities, the line of accountability must be quite clear. But as it's been raised, and I don't think the intention was to oppose the raising of the age, but rather to raise the concern that raising the age from 7 to 10, considering our context, would it not encourage people to use more physically able children, let's say even 12-year-olds, to commit crime if you were to remove the criminal capacity? Would it not make children more vulnerable? Are we assuming that all the other sort of systems in place that this bill attempts to put in will be in place to protect them from that kind of exploitation? And I don't think when we look at our own context we can actually push for those sort of jumps. I think we have to be very specific about it. And we work in schools, sorry for not introducing it properly earlier, that the Catholic Institute looked at 352 Catholic schools. And just as you know that we are diverse, about 70% of the children in Catholic schools are not Catholic, and 90% of them are black. So that's we are quite represented, and we're worried about a lot of these sort of making children more vulnerable, and we're actually supposed to be talking about a child justice law and improving their protection. But we do understand that this is what happens when that other system fails, so we're not going to go into that too much more. But I think just, I went through a couple of those examples from yesterday as you were speaking about, and Brazil was an interesting one, because although Brazil has this thing of 18 years old, formally in the statute, the criminal capacity is 12. What they do have is a completely separate criminal justice system for youth and adolescents, or people up to the age of 18, where the measures and the sentencing is different to what would happen in the formal adult system. So we've got to ask ourselves, is that the kind of thing that we want? Or do we want a kind of hybrid mix there? And I don't think we've actually seen all the different explorations, and maybe NGOs and other civil society members should make those options available. But it's just interesting to see that also in dealing with the issue of raising of the criminal capacity, one of the bigger problems is the rebuttable presumption and how that's been dealt with. Currently, and even in the Law Reform Commission, there was the question of, is a rebuttable presumption on a balance of probabilities or beyond a reasonable doubt, as the current version of the bill says, which gives it a lot more strength in terms of the state needing to prove that the child has criminal capacity up to the age of 14. And then a lot of the kind of worries that we have about extending it would fall away. We're dealing with something quite different here. And looking just sort of at countries in Africa generally that have populations of children over 10 million children, and it's important that we make that analogy as well. We can't compare ourselves to Liberia, which has significantly less children. With the exception of Egypt and Tanzania, the rest of them are still at the age of 7, for whatever reason. And maybe we're at a similar path, but I think it's, again, to just reiterate the need to make these challenges. And Chair, I think the rest of our submission was quite well drafted, so you can have a look at those. And we've gone clause by clause. There's no point in reiterating them now. So open for questions.
There are two pieces of legislation that must be read together with each other, and try and address the other issue that you raised in that regard. The Criminal Procedure Act, there are provisions at the moment in the Act, Criminal Procedure Act, dealing exclusively with children. Those provisions have either been amended or more than likely being repealed. So the criminal and they will be, those provisions will be dealt with in the child justice book. So the two must be read together, and there's no question of subordination.
We're talking about us being the Minimum Diversity Program. What will happen is, we won't have bills, Kevin. We will have the table of the Parliament. That's good for you, because the internet actually has more access to information. So, although, Jim, when it comes to regulation, can we have public hearings on it? We can. So we don't know. I'm just asking as a general rule.
What the purposes of them being tabled in Parliament? If Parliament has got some kind of say over whether Parliament has to approve or can object, then you should have hearings. But if it's tabled from information point of view, I think it still has
we should look at this. Even if the Parliament cannot amend the regulation, it might be useful at times for the public to use the communication besides via the executive version of a bill. We are hoping that this Parliament is going to operate. I want to tell you, we make the only intentions about public warning. But I want you to know that one of the things about it, whether you support it or didn't support, if you listen to what the new chief would be saying, if you read the Sunday City thing, if you read the Sunday Times, what he's saying, they haven't had it for a long time. Parliament is
still have a chance for being taken. I foresee, and this committee was constantly working, returning to the 94th and 98th period. So all these issues, we don't have time right now to discuss. We need to look at it. If Parliament is to be an organ of popular power, as the National Democratic Movement wanted it to be, you may use different words, team of Europe, liberal democrat, whatever you are, I don't know what label one uses for a TH. You might say different things, but do you believe that Parliament is the organ of popular power? That means access to information has been made available. No one needs to be cagey about it. This Parliament has allowed you to speak at public hearings given the law of the land and constitutional. And we also must have regulations, because a lot of legislation gets centrally picked through by regulation. Because the committees are so preoccupied with those, we don't look at regulation. That too we need to look at very carefully. But you are clear, it's not that basically you're not talking about those. You're just talking about regulation in
At the timing and tabling in Parliament of the policy framework and accreditation system, and then also the diversion options themselves, that's just be tabled in Parliament. So that's not, I wouldn't even consider that.
Parliament, you're consult with the public when you do the accreditation system. Then it makes our life easier, Parliament. A few of these people will come here and say the same thing. But let's not discuss that. That's another thing we need to look at. Hopefully, if you will come to some solution on that, yeah.
So maybe I should quickly point out now that the diversion program, as well as all relevant details, such as duration and content thereof, must be tabled in Parliament for approval. So in that case, Parliament must have approved them.
Then the next thing is, you might have something to say.
There's a comment from the Inquisition that, the comment was made, but it's constantly a name, the age of civil responsibility. They are the way, making better capitalists, criminals out there, syndicates, to be used in criminal actors.
But that has to balance out with all the elements of the system. So is this how that works, JJ?
Just with the criminal capacity issue, I know just the oral submission has watered down the written submission. The written submission is quite firm.
Yeah.
For six to 10 years, the criminal capacity issue came as problematic. We therefore strongly opposed the extension. And even with the Catholic Bishops Conference submission, which I haven't seen, I think the written submission is also much more stronger than the oral presentation. The concern that they've raised is about children being used to commit criminal acts. We've heard from Professor John Nielsen that's now illegal. But I think the issue that relationship still has to be proved. And a child, an 11-year-old, could be intimidated to, not say anything and everything etc. So I think that is something one has to look at. I'm in favor of 10, as I mean, so that it's useful having something to look at for 10. It's too high. But anyway, just that point. The other thing I thought that Mr. Bassett was, the issue of the reference to the minister. That's because the ministers, at the moment you don't have a minister of justice. You have a minister of justice and constitutional development. The next president could decide that you're not going to have a minister of education, you're going to have a minister of education and science and technology. So that's why those titles change. So that's why the minister responsible then is more easy to define. It might seem more technical and rather cumbersome, but that's why that is there.
Just also on that, I think we also take up to, I think, minister responsible for such and such in the constitution, I think they
so all those are doing that. The agenda and local government,
So you started with Minister of Provincial Local Government and Constitutional Development.
Now, all the departments are doing that. do that. Okay, well, so now, so we bring this to conclusion with the following without changing the three syllable state quotation of this I'm going to offer. You see the last paragraph on that one. So now,
sorry, I just want to make a comment about the QBAT issue. This is about children being used by adults to commit crimes. So adults use children, and we see from a lot of research on this, 800 children interviewed over several studies, urban and children, rural children. I wrote this report myself. I interviewed these children myself. The adults who use children don't care whether the children get caught or not caught. So the criminal capacity issue actually doesn't matter. They don't care whether the child is held responsible or not. They just want to remove themselves from responsibility for the offense. So when you talk to these children, their experiences regularly tell you that adults don't care, and that what they tend to do is use a number of different measures, apart from this intimidation as well, to get children to do things for them. So the intimidation question is often less of an issue than the using of little rewards to engage children, etc., etc. So I think the age issue in terms of criminal capacity, the QBAT thing should be removed, I think, because it really, the research shows us, South African research shows us, it doesn't really matter. Adults don't care what their age is and whether they're going to get caught or not.
I'm sure that's correct, but the problem would be if you, let's say you raise it to 12. I mean, I'm sure you're correct that the adults don't care, they just don't want to be caught, but they want the benefit of the child doing what they want to do. But the difficulty is if it's 11 and there's no capacity, that child can get caught because they don't have capacity, they're then released. Whereas if they have got capacity, or at least if it's a rebuttable presumption or whatever, even if you're noting the concerns with that, it becomes more difficult. So it's not so much the adult, it's the child and being prevented.
I mean, the impact is there, but if you don't get it fixed, it's the full might of the criminal justice system here. And then it might be an incentive for them to stop the city, that's not the sentence here, that is.
So I'm not sure we're going to reply to that, but we'll leave it for now. Can I suggest that the following thing? So see, I'm addressing myself mainly to the civil society actors here. I want to begin with them. One is that we're going to focus on the regional court issues below and get it out of the way as soon as possible. We're going to finish the public hearing next Tuesday on this child justice story. However, the public hearing don't end formally as such. We've got a two-person committee, but any of you can also write to us at any time. We've got Lolly's details, and you've got hopefully Christine's details, and between the two of them, they will facilitate your positions being brought before the committee. All the submissions will be arranged by us collectively, like us, and we'll be getting us. As we'll continue to get your choice, and hopefully Lolly, if you can, because we've got a thousand other things to do. So at least three of us will get everything. The department will summarize in block form, you know, clause one, as you know, we do, you are to do that. But if the two of you want to also, because you're suspicious of this process, and there's no reason why you shouldn't keep, we as Parliament are suspicious, and that's our constitutional obligation to be suspicious of them. Otherwise, there's no separation of powers. So what we're going to do is, when they do their thing, either Christine and or I or Sue Ann will do all that, we'll check everything, but they haven't left out something. Don't take any deliberate need about you humans. You have unconscious biases, and you will obviously need things out, just like I need things out as well, as much as I try to be objective. So we will check that document. But we will give the two of you a copy of that document. You will go through it and you will see it. Say, but they didn't cover the point, so you also have to get it. We will also look into your participation. It's been done on the property rates bill, on 25 bills that I've shared, where you continue to participate, two of you, within limitations. Do not limit the parliament. So we will draw you in when we have to, and otherwise you can't observe. Also, give us some time. We need time, both as a committee and as ANC in particular, the study group, to give us time to give what we think about this. So, you know, we'll start the process of looking at this bill after the public hearing is finished on Tuesday. The first phase of the public hearing is, say, towards the end of March. So we will need about 2 weeks or so. organize ourselves. At that time, we will then come back and look at the policy issue, broad stuff, broad stuff, broad, and then we will advise you. But Lottie will keep in touch with you regularly, and Christine is tabulating as well. So both of them will be accessible to you. But you also have to be acting like politicians, have a plan B. There's no way you're going to get everything you want, even when we agree with you. So you must start also helping the process by saying, okay, this is what we want. You give them the document and say, this is what we want. But if we cannot get it, this is what we will settle for. It will save time. Okay, is there anything any member wants to add to what I've just said about process issues? We will, these are my own views for now. I would imagine the majority of the study group will agree, but I don't know. I only know the three. This is my proposal for now.
We should be pretty far doing this.
Sorry? No, we will finish by the time we have to finish. Now, for somebody who was around in this village in 2002, it is particularly rich of you to tell me that 3 months is a long time. Is there a disciplinary subcommittee that needs to subject these to? Put it mildly, that's an outrageous thing. But no, I get your point. We've seen this before, there is no reason. Can I just say one final thing that astonishes me? Just to somehow think this committee is different, you know? Somehow this committee is superior to other committees. It's just another committee with more legislation than most do. We sat, the property rate goes for 320 hours, and we finished it within 3 months. So we shall sit till 4 in the morning if we have to, but we shall finish the talk. However, there is nothing to hide. My friend did something very clever with the Neubauer of ANC, that's between him and me, I think July I can say. It's a very clever thing you said, except you see, let's be these frank with all of you. This bill is far more complex and difficult, simply in the way it is written, let alone the politicians, than personally I ever imagined. And having allocated a small number of slots I've allocated, that's completely out. It's good, I think. I allocated 7 or 8 slots. We're not going to finish that time. Point two is that we have got to do the judicial court project. The deadline for that lapses in June. Now, you have to give it the 30 days, just like to the National House and all that. Yeah. So, we have to finish that bill in some culture. Then the DSO bill, whatever outcome finally is, we have some role or other to play, but from what I can gather, it's the Safety and Security Committee that will play the major role, and we will sit with them. It's what I think is going to happen. I can't speak for the Speaker or the Chief of the Office, but I might know a bit more, I don't know. But I think both of us are going to sit jointly where possible. And so we can't simply start our program without looking at the Safety and Security Committee. So that also applies. So it is possible we will not finish this bill in the first half of this year. But we will have a better quality bill. And hey, the rate is 5 years. So it started in 96, from what I can tell from one of your submissions. But actually, it came out more than anybody else. 96 is up, you know, in the first issue of the week. So it's now how many years later? 12 years later. So if you put an extra 3 weeks beyond June for the 12 years, it's not something that we need to worry about. Now, Steve, I just think you will be even stronger about some of the issues than ANC, because we all need to spend more time to fight the king. Let's see how things go. We will finish this call, whatever happens, and we are asking for help as Parliament, not civil society, and we will set the parameters for that. Ultimately, we will make the decision. We are the elected parliamentarians, and you have the right to not have these. Do that in a session. Set up your own party and stand for election later. You don't vote for us, that is your right. But ultimately, we are the elected representatives. So we're not going to abdicate our role to you. But we will, in the best positions of a national democratic transformation, make Parliament what it is. And it will be alive and exciting and consultative, like it was in the first few years. And that's what I think we must commit ourselves to do. And that is anyway what the Chief will say. I'll refer you to the City Press this past Sunday and the Sunday Times. As I refer you to the interview we gave in the early part of last week to the newspapers, as I refer you to a clipping I saw on SABC for what he has to say. So, I think that's very important that I'm not speaking to myself alone for now, at least two of us comrade Lati is here to run my property. Shit, so, hey, the boss is giving so, you can't get what I do. Right? So we will consult. And the first consultation is 5 minutes, no more. Thank you very much, all. And get the contact details for